Welcome to Breaking Down the Buzz, the podcast where we explore the thrilling world of tech industry leaders. From AI to the latest trends, we cut through the noise and decode the tech buzz and share our collective insights and insider knowledge. Welcome back to Breaking Down the Buzz. In this episode, I interviewed Nathan Kottkamp. Nathan Kottkamp is not only a distinguished attorney that specializes in healthcare regulations, but also a competitive cyclist. In today's episode, we'll navigate through the complexities of ransomware in healthcare, explore legal strategies for cybersecurity, and even take a detour into how Nathan's cycling discipline influences his professional resilience. Stay tuned for an enlightening conversation full of legal insights and life lessons from the fast lane. Thank you for joining us. We're super excited to have you here on the podcast. I'd love it if you could tell us kind of about what you do.
Sure. I'm Nathan Kottkamp, and I am a healthcare attorney here in Richmond. I have a practice that covers pretty much the full array of healthcare providers, whether it's physician practices, hospitals, senior living facilities, and I'm kind of a jack of all trades. When things go off, I try and come in and fix problems, and otherwise I deal with all the things that happen behind the desk when you come in and sign in. All that stuff is sort of in my bailiwick.
Okay. So obviously I'm a technologist, and So we're going to talk a little bit about technology. And I know that you are involved from a legal perspective in how companies prepare for breaches and also respond to breaches, not from a technology perspective, but from a legal perspective.
Right.
Would love to hear about that.
Right. Well, what you mentioned is actually very important, because I do get questions from my clients about the particulars of technology. And I say, look, I'm not a tech person. Go to Synergy. Go to somewhere else that is going to be able to help you in that manner. And it's actually a point of caution that I want to mention is sometimes I've got clients who will come to me and they've said, oh, we've done an audit, we've worked with Synergy, we've identified some issues, here's the report, can you help us now, like, keep it all privileged and confidential? I said, look, I can't do that. You've already got a document that has a roadmap of your technological shortfalls. If you had come to me first, then we could do that investigation and the audit under privilege. So that is one caution for anybody who's out there. Now, there's a HIPAA requirement that you do audits as well, and those aren't protected. But some of the other stuff that's peripheral and that's sort of day-to-day operations, it really is important that they are working with counsel, not because we have any tech expertise, but rather to protect it legally.
So if I'm preparing for a cybersecurity audit, what I really should be doing is calling in you or the counsel that I'm working with and saying, work with me alongside this audit to prepare for it?
It's almost, it's hard to describe it, almost like in front.
Okay.
So we serve as the intermediary. So what happens is the client hires my law firm and we subcontract with the tech vendor. So the tech vendor answers to me as counsel, and then I advise my clients based on the tech response.
Okay.
But if you go directly to the tech vendor, that you can't enjoy privilege and you can't go back. There's no retroactive privilege.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how does that change things then? If I didn't do that and my organization suffered a breach, what's the implications there?
Well, there's a variety of things that can happen, but one of them is if you get into any sort of issues with the government and they are trying to get to the bottom of what happened, if you have counsel engaged, then you at least have an argument that they don't get to see all the work product and all the machinations that go into it. Because in many cases, what will happen is you'll get an audit and they identify some areas of potential problems. And the expectation is that you go and fix them.
Right.
But if you've got a document that says, well, you've known about this vulnerability for a year and a half and you didn't fix it, that's a big, big problem. So at least having the layer of potential privilege. I say potential because it's not guaranteed.
Right.
But at least you've got that argument to make as opposed to just having a roadmap for civil or potentially criminal penalties from the government.
Wow. I think most people would not even consider that. Most organizations probably haven't thought about that at all.
Yeah.
You know. And so now I'm going to say this out loud, and I'm not speaking it into existence. Now I've been breached.
Yeah.
What am I doing?
First and foremost, you better have cyber insurance, and you better call your cyber insurance company. Usually, that's the first call. A lot of times, I and my colleagues are the first call, and what we routinely do is say, okay, you need to get off the phone with me right now. Go call your insurance company. And part of the reason that is just protecting your bottom line.
Right.
Most, and this has been an evolution of cyber insurance over the last decade or so, most of them now use panel counsel in the same way that medical malpractice or liability. They've got a set of lawyers around the country. That's all they do for the health insurers. And so I'm happy to work with somebody, but they're going to be paying my rates as opposed to the discount rate. But it's also important you don't want to potentially miss the window for having a claim be qualified, things like that.
But okay.
Usually my recommendation is get insurance involved immediately. For some of my clients, I will serve as a backstop or like a second opinion. So they'll get referred off to panel counsel, and panel counsel will do a bunch of stuff, and it's confusing, and they don't understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. The panel counsel is moving too fast. They got too many other things. So they'll come to me and say, Nathan, what are they doing here? Can you explain this? And so that's the way that sometimes I support my clients, is supplemental in that regard. And otherwise, one of the big things that my role entails with a breach is just helping clients calm down.
You know, okay.
It feels like the world is about to end, and you feel like you're the target of something, and it's personal and all these things. And as I'm sure you know too,
right?
The cyber criminals are ahead of the best technology by, I think it's the last time I saw, it was like 6 months. So they're hitting everybody that they can. When they find a vulnerability, they do it. It's not personal. Right. And so that's one of the things. It's just like trying to keep them calm. And there's a lot of value in that. There really is.
Right,
so,
right. Do you get involved at all in helping craft statements to the public
Yes.
or any of that?
Oh, yes. So you've probably received those letters that happen.
Sure.
We all do.
Yeah.
And part of it is we sort of just get immune to them because we see so many. But yes, I get involved in drafting those. Sometimes there's media statements. Sometimes there's holding statements that we'll have for the media, depending on the nature of a breach. And some of those are pretty tricky because, again, you don't want to be introducing potential liability for yourself based on what you're disclosing about the
right.
facts. But at the same time, particularly in healthcare, people are freaked out because
right.
health information is special in that it's everlasting. So like if you get a credit card stolen or your bank account gets hacked in some way, they just change the numbers and you change the logins and all that
right.
stuff and you're fine. But you can't change your health history.
Right.
It's with you forever. And
right.
so that's one of the reasons that health information is routinely, when they do sort of the price list, if you will, on the black web, the dark web, health insurance is always way more valuable than financial information because
really?
Of its evergreen qualities.
Really?
Yeah.
So how, and I'm not in this space at all, how I recognize that my medical history doesn't change, but how is that valuable to somebody?
Well, I'm not a cyber criminal, so I don't have it all dialed
okay,
in.
Fair.
But what I can tell you is there are all sorts of schemes to use health information for like false billing. So if you've assembled somebody's medical record and you know about their, I'll just make this up. You know they have diabetes,
okay.
right? And so they are going to get insulin and other services on a routine basis. Well, somebody who hacks into that can produce bogus invoices, send them to pharmacies, get paid. You know, there's all sorts of things that they can do, but those are some of the ways. It's mostly insurance fraud of various sorts, mm-hmm. but I mean, theoretically it could be blackmail kinds of things. You know, I've given an example of all the connected devices. Like, can you imagine what would happen if you discovered that you have a connected pacemaker and someone has hacked it and they're like, you pay up, otherwise I shut your heart down.
Wow.
And those are I'm not aware of that happening, but like I see the potential for that. And so that's another place where just the more connected we get, the more vulnerability there is. And
I wear a watch. You're an athlete also, right? So you probably do similar things. I wear this watch that tracks like literally everything all day long. It's, you know, my heart rate, my HRV, sort of all of that. And Garmin had a pretty good hack a few years ago. I don't think they were collecting the kind of health data that they're collecting on people now. And I always wonder, like, what if they got hacked and someone got access to, you know, my resting heart rate, my kind of all this stuff. Yep. Where is the value in that? And I wonder if, you know, we're probably not that far away from, can somebody start to use biometric data that now they have hacked?
My guess is that the value of that is not an independent, it's not in the inherent value of that. It's when you take that information, you somehow merge it with other data. That's where it probably becomes valuable. One of the interesting things that we deal with all the time is this perception that everything related to health is covered by HIPAA. Everyone knows about HIPAA.
Right.
But your Garmin information is not covered by HIPAA. It's not healthcare related.
That's and so
people sort of project HIPAA on places that it doesn't belong. The other interesting thing about HIPAA that I think some of your listeners might be interested in is knowing that for all the things that we do about HIPAA and all the concerns that we have, there is no private right of action under HIPAA. So if you are a patient who's been the victim of a misuse of your health insurance, you think like HIPAA is this big structure, you know, you've got all these protections and rights. Can I sue the provider for that? There's no mechanism for that. It's wild.
Wow.
So the only recourse as a patient is to file a complaint with the government.
So like in a scenario where I have Anthem insurance and Anthem gets hacked, I have no claim against Anthem?
Nope.
No. That is interesting. Nope. I did not know
you
that.
You theoretically have a claim at the state level, but most of them are around the state around the country are capped at $1,000 damages. So as an individual, you're never going to find a lawyer who's going to go sue Anthem for $1,000.
Right.
But what they do is they take all the people and go with a class action. And so that's where you get, you see these massive, massive lawsuits against folks who have been hacked. But that's not exactly for the HIPAA breach. It's more just a general, hey, my information was affected.
My data's out there. You said something to me earlier when we were having coffee that was interesting. And that was that under HIPAA, you really have 60 days to notify of a breach.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah. So it's no more than 60 days is what the reg says. And then of course, you can't treat that as like a deadline, like a target.
Right.
The notion is you got to move fast, and particularly in this data-driven world that we live in, if you become known as an entity that's been sitting on a breach, you're going to get scoured in the regular media, social media, whatever.
Right.
So really the expectation is you've got to move quick. One of the things I see all the time are these business associate agreements that are in place between lawyers and providers, contractors and providers, and they'll ask for 24 hours notice, which makes great sense if you're the hospital. But if you're a big company, you don't even know up from down when you've got an alleged breach in 24 hours. Like it takes time. So it's a push and pull between needing to move fast, but needing to be moving carefully so that you're not causing undue alarm. Sometimes something that looks like a breach really isn't. So you don't want to be like crying wolf and things like that. So, and then the flip side is some of the worst situations are these ransomware attacks lately, where they're not really going for the data. They're going for the fact that they've locked up the data.
Right.
And so, not always, but if a company pays the ransom and they get their data unencrypted again, that at least needs to be treated as a breach. And you probably have a lousy argument that it wasn't a breach. But it's kind of a weird thing to have to tell
your data didn't leave.
Well, you think it didn't leave,
but you don't.
You've been given an assurance by a cyber criminal. So how much do you put faith in that? So those are some of the ones that are tricky for our clients to understand. Like, well, we got the data back. What's the problem? Like, that's just kind of how it is.
Yeah. I mean, my questions would be, so there would be some things that we would recommend to do. So first of all, we recommend that you apply labeling and tag all of your data, you know, so that if it leaves, it can't necessarily be opened. That doesn't change that your data is being held hostage. You know, just because you've, and this is a little bit technical, but just because you've applied data labeling and encryption to data doesn't mean you can't encrypt around it, right? But my concern would always be the cyber criminal might tell me that my data didn't leave, but it may have left anyway. And what if now, you know, 3 years from now, it's hostage again?
Yeah.
And that's the issue.
They give it back, but they give it back with a worm or a virus.
And right.
It deploys sometime later. Right. You know, the other thing we've seen with ransomware is if you pay once, does that mean you're going to be willing to pay again? So like the repeat target.
Right.
So there's all sorts of things. I actually joke that it's not really a joke, that it's really sort of a game theory issue. So the cyber criminals have to behave with some level of integrity. So for some portion of the folks that they are asking for ransom and get paid, they got to give the data back. Mm. Otherwise, the industry is going to talk and they're like, well, don't pay that. You'll never get it back. And so, you know, it's just sort of like this. Yeah. How much do you pay? How much do you not pay? It's a complicated dance for sure.
If you were going to guess, and again, you can choose not to answer this, in that scenario, how often do companies really pay versus try and do something else?
I don't know, because they don't, you know, it's one of these things where you kind of want to stay under the radar, but I do know that payment happens on a regular basis. I guess the one caution that I'd say is that there are lists of organizations that are mostly foreign or otherwise criminal, that if you make a payment to one of those, you're actually committing a federal crime.
Really?
So there's some extra reasons to be cautious about paying. And then there's like these payment brokers, which sort of blows my mind, but they're literally professionals who their job is to be an intermediary to negotiate the extent of the ransom between the good guys and the bad guys.
Wow.
It is mind blowing.
Like virtual repo, man.
Yeah.
Wow.
But people do pay, and some who pay get their information back. And that's one of the reasons why people keep paying.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
In the healthcare world, what constitutes a breach? And I'm going to caveat that with, you know, you might have someone gain access to your environment, but at what point do you really need to disclose that something's happened? Is there a magnitude of size or?
There is a four question analysis that has to be done, a breach analysis. And the ultimate answer is whether or not there is a low probability of compromise. There are no bright lines in any of the four questions. And so it's like this sort of pushing and pulling and a little bit of Ouija board, a little bit of Venn diagram, and, you know, some just sort of gut feeling. But the problem is the presumption is there's been a breach unless you prove otherwise. You're not trying to prove a breach. You're trying to prove no breach. And that's where you run into a challenge, like with the ransomware. So you've had your data compromised through encryption. It gets locked up. Can you really say that it wasn't compromised? You can't say that it hasn't. And so you can't overcome the presumption of the law. And that's why you end up having to notify several thousands, millions, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's
big numbers.
It's certainly every CIO's worst nightmare, and it's every CEO's worst nightmare. It's everybody's worst nightmare. No one wants to end up on the front page for something like that.
No.
You know, it's just none of us do.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I think, you know, for as much as we're talking about tech, we have to talk about people.
Right.
Because when you get down to the reality of most breaches, it's actually a person issue. You know, getting through technology, and I don't do this, but that's hard stuff. Like you're having to compete with, you know, the bad guys are competing with the good guys. But human fallibility is out there in unlimited quantities. And that's why we see phishing. And that's why we see all these other things. That's not going away. So one of the things that I think organizations need to be really mindful of is, I don't care how good your tech is, if your people aren't watching.
Agreed.
It's virtually useless.
Yes, agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. I mean, almost every security issue that we deal with from our customers is the result of a human being not paying attention, or we're starting to see this now, MFA fatigue, where you have to, you know, do a second factor for everything. And it's happening so often that people are just, yep, I did it. And when in reality, it's not them. So what we're starting to see is with MFA, for the most part, we work with Microsoft technology. When that prompt comes up, it tells you the actual location of where the person is attempting to sign in from. Oh, so you can say, okay, no, I'm not in Phoenix, Arizona right now. This is not me.
Yeah.
Because that's what's happening. People are just, yep.
Well, as a real life example of the magnitude of the issue, I have a former colleague who was the chair of our cyber legal team. And he got the yellow screen experience because he was on a webinar. He was multitasking. He was just trying to clean out his inbox. And so he's just going through stuff and he clicked on something that was phishing. It was actually it was one of those intentional phishings where they were trying to do education within the firm. And so you think of all the people who would be ready to know what's out there and to see the phishing coming. And it's because he was distracted. Yep. You know, it's so easy to just let your guard down.
Yeah, particularly if you're on your phone.
Yeah.
It's very, very easy on your phone to just say, oh, yeah, let me look at this PDF or this whatever it is that's been sent to me. I mean, I personally don't open any attachments unless I know who they're coming from, because it's such a big deal.
And that's undoubtedly a best practice. Again, we spend so much time talking about thinking about documenting, contracting around all the technology, and it is the people part is so important.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. I'm going to pivot on you for just a minute here, because this is a question that really I have being a business owner.
Yeah.
How do you feel about AI in the legal world, and how does that impact you?
Well, either the sky is falling or it's a wonderful, addition to what we do as lawyers. Right. I think it's somewhere in between. As we were talking at coffee, I think the best way to approach AI in the legal field is to think of it as a tool. It's not a solution. It's kind of like having another associate, one that's doesn't have a heartbeat. But in the same way that when younger attorneys bring me a work product, it's my job to check it.
Right.
I don't know where AI is pulling its case law from, where it's pulling its information. It's only as good as the foundation of data that it's consuming and processing. So we've already seen cases where attorneys have been reprimanded for just filing something that they produced through AI. And that's,
how does that even happen? Like, I get how it happens, but how, as an attorney, do you file something that you haven't verified?
Well, I think some of it can be a workload issue.
Okay.
Some of it is just lazy lawyering. some of it could be like extreme fee sensitivity, where the client's just like, hey, I just want you to file something. Just get us into court, do whatever.
Okay.
And if you're in that situation, you're the lawyer, you're not really thinking, well, I'm actually, a custodian of the law, like I'm an agent of the court or whatever that term is. You're not thinking about that when you've got your client hounding you to just get something filed and get it out the door. And so I think that's how it sometimes happens. I completely understand the sanctions from courts that say, I don't care what your pressure is.
Yeah.
And particularly if you're in a law firm, the assumption is you've got other people to check it. So if you're a solo practitioner, maybe there's a little bit of leeway there. But there's usually not a whole lot of grace given when you've got colleagues who you can say, hey, can you read this brief of mine? That's the expectation. That's why you work in a firm.
Right, right. I think of AI the same way. You know, we use AI every day. We certainly use it in our marketing organization, and we use it for a lot of things. My opinion on it is AI today, and I'm talking about tools like ChatGPT or even Microsoft 365 Copilot, is like a really good intern. Like, you could have an intern that's really, really smart, and they can do really good research, and they can put together something that's really great for you. But in the end, you got to read it, you got to check it, and you're going to have to fix it because they're an intern. They don't have the business experience that you do. They, you know, they don't necessarily know what to look for except for what they've been told to look for.
Right.
And AI is great, but human intuition is a real thing, and you can read something and say what that. Right. It just doesn't, I don't know why it doesn't feel right, but it doesn't feel right.
Well, an AI is designed to replicate.
Right.
And so you could be perpetually replicating something that's just a lousy model, or it's inefficient, or things that if you were to just step back and look at it with a human brain, you might say, isn't it time to evolve that document, that process, that legal theory, whatever? But you're not going to get that if you're AI. You'll never get that.
Right, right. And it can only replicate what it's been trained on.
Right.
So the interesting place for me in that, in the legal world is, you know, there are all kinds of cases that were the first of their time. Mm-hmm. AI is never going to replicate that because it's never going to think about, okay, well, that law was written 100 years ago.
Yep.
Maybe we need to change it, or maybe, you know, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm making stuff up here, but it just feels to me like the opportunity for everything to look the same and for us to remain stagnant as a society.
Yeah. Well, you want, the law to evolve, and that's just part of how it's that never ending evolution towards perfection, which of course will never be achieved, but it is supposed to be getting incrementally better.
Right.
And the only way it's going to get incrementally better is when somebody does something like look at we're seeing this right now, right? You look at a U.S. Constitution amendment and you're like, huh, I wonder if we've all been looking at that wrong.
Right.
And let's see if we can make this particular argument. AI is never going to do that.
Right.
Ever. So I think there is a component of the law that's just going to depend on brains forever.
Right.
And that's a good thing.
Yeah, that is a good thing.
A lawyer, that's a good thing.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and I think it's going to potentially make things a little bit easier for you, but it's not going to change what you do. You're still
going to do it. No, it tends to be a situation where it just shifts some of the focus and shifts where the workload ends up being. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to back off. And if anything, what it may do is expand the volume of work, because it's so much easier to produce things like a brief.
Right.
That we just get more of them. And longer. Exactly. Yeah. And so we may end up what we lose in sort of efficiency as lawyers, we may pick up in volume just because it's more there, it's easier to do.
Right, right. Yeah. So, you know, the prevailing question is AI going to take jobs away? And what you're saying is, for lawyers, probably not.
No.
Probably not.
We're pretty good at keeping job security as a profession.
I would agree with that, yes. Because as soon as there's one involved, there's...
Yeah, for better or for
like
worse.
Like rabbits.
Now, I try not to practice that way, but it is kind of a feature of the practice overall.
Yes, 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 yes. I get it. Awesome. Well, thank you. I really appreciate you coming
delighted
in to chat with
chat,
me.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was super fun. All right. Well, just, you know, let's keep in touch and hopefully we don't have to work together on anything, because that means somebody's been breached, likely.
Or at least we're working on the front end.
Yes, exactly.
That would
be
delightful.
Yes. Awesome. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
All right.